The moments like that, or when you get to play with people who are better than you, who have like been on the block so many times, who have this experience, that's what really inspires you and brings up your level of musicianship, because obviously you have to hang on.
Welcome to episode 88 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. www.lemurmusic.com. Everything you need for the double bass. This was a very special week for Lemur Music and the Lemur Music family. Founder of Lemur Music, Mr. Murray Grodner, turned 100 years old on Tuesday, August 23rd. A very, very happy birthday to Mr. Murray Grodner. In other news, Lemur Music is presenting Bass Benefits by the Beach on September the 3rd. This is a gathering of local artists and musicians to raise funds for programs supporting those with special needs and the Silver Lake Music Conservatory. Head over to lemurmusic.com for more information. Musicians, artists, if you have some tunes you'd like to have released into the world, huh? Check out finet.com. Finet.com is a music distribution platform created by musicians for musicians. They incorporate blockchain and NFT technologies. It is free to sign up and free to upload your content. Also, check out episode 76 of the Bass Shed Podcast, where I talk to the owners of the company about the company and specifically the blockchain and NFT technologies, because I didn't know anything about that stuff, like at all. If you're also unfamiliar with it, head over to episode 76, learn about it while I learn about it. Check out finet.com. Folks, if you're teaching private lessons, check out blinklesson.app. This software is the one-stop shop and has all the tools and resources you're going to need for managing a private lessons studio. Go to thebassshed.com, click on the logo for Blink Lessons, and get an extended free trial period. Yes, yes, yes. It is a 30-day trial period. You have a month. You got a month to check it out, snoop around. I love the software. Head over to thebassshed.com, click on it, start your 30-day free trial period for managing your private lessons studio, blinklesson.app. All right, my guest on episode 88 is double bassist and electric bassist Benjamin J. Shepherd. Ben was born and raised in Wellington, New Zealand. A little backstory here. Ben started playing when he was 7 years old. 11 years later, when he's 18, he moved to Los Angeles to pursue a full-time music career and to study the bass with legends, Charlie Hayden, Alfonso Johnson, Derek Oles. All those dudes are crushing. He studied with them at the California Institute of Arts, also known as Cal Arts. His studio and live credits include Chance the Rapper. Ben was the bassist on Grammy-winning album Coloring Book. He has also worked with Kamasi Washington, Lee Ritenour, Patrice Rushen, Marquise Hill, Dave Weckl, Billy Childs, Peter Erskine, Simon Phillips, Jeff Lorber, Mike Stern, John Beasley, and Monkestra, which was a Grammy-nominated and winning group and record. He has also worked with Miguel Atwood Ferguson and many, many more. Benjamin also leads his own group, showcasing his original compositions, as well as co-leads a duo-based group called Benjamin and Deva with singer-songwriter Tara Deva. He currently endorses Ibanez basses, Aguilar amplification, AccuGroove cabinets, Groove Gear accessories, GH strings, and exotic pedals. I met Ben some years ago just on the scene in Los Angeles, and I remember when he kind of hit the scene, and he was on everybody's gig, all the time. Like, cool, here's the new group at, you know, whatever club with whatever cats. Ben was on the gig, just crushing it. Ben is a ridiculous bass player. Check him out whenever and however you get the chance. Listening to him play is so incredibly inspiring. Here it is. Here's my interview with Grammy Award-winning double bassist and electric bassist Benjamin J. Shepherd.
Hey, Ryan.
Dude, how you been, man? It's been a while. When did you move? When did you leave LA?
Well, actually, just I'm just visiting here for a while.
Okay.
Just for a little bit, you know, my parents are down here and all that, so we're just kind of hanging out and whatnot. But
did you was that pandemic induced?
That was part of it too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just needed to kind of just get a break, and you know, we had, you know, being around, you know, family as well, and you know, it's a chance for my parents to also get to be around their, you know, granddaughter as well. So it's
It all works out. How old's your daughter?
She's 4 years old.
Wow.
So, exactly. Yeah. The time just like goes by. It's like, okay. Yeah. I'm counting the gray hairs on my head already.
Yeah.
So it's actually pretty cool. It's like, all right, you know, getting older and whatnot. So.
Some of it's cool until you realize you just have heartburn all day. You know, that's just a part of my day now.
Right. And realizing, oh, I can't really eat so much of the stuff that I used to in my 20s.
I know.
Like, huh, okay, yeah. A lot of those, like late...
Oh, this is a thing. Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, though, we're just chugging along, and it's been great to, of course, you know, got these two cats with me right here, so which is really good, you know, especially the new one.
Let me see it.
Right,
what
here.
Do you got there?
This is this is my brand new custom made
the new Ibanez
BTB. This was made at the Los Angeles custom shop.
Okay.
And this was to my specifications, and yes, it's based on a BTB model, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
That
body shape
is very, but there are some differences from a typical BTB. Usually a BTB is about 35 inch scale.
Okay.
A little longer. This is 34. I like the 34, just so I don't have to reach down so much.
Yeah.
You know, that's the really cool thing about it, is it's really comfortable. The neck, like the grip and the width essentially is the same.
Okay.
Of my groove line bass here that a lot of people have seen me play.
Also an Ibanez.
Yeah. I only play Ibanez basses. I don't have any other basses apart from the upright bass, which is a Shen. But all my bass guitars are Ibanez. But this one, course.
If the video of this doesn't get released, let's talk about the pickup configuration. So you have two single coils and a P bass. Style in the middle.
Yeah.
And what looks to be air traffic control knobs.
I
think I'm counting about 29 toggle switches on this bass.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah. One is for room service, the wake up call, ejection seat. Exactly. When the gig is done and you want your car to, like, as soon as you get out the door, your car is waiting for you right
Amazing.
There.
Amazing. Amazing.
Exactly. So this pickup configuration is not anything new. We've seen this before on other basses, particularly someone like Stu Ham, like on his old Fender Urge bass. Jimmy Earl is another person that I've seen on who's done that. But I just wanted to do something a little different, essentially from what I've typically done, just to try something new, and I've been digging it. So essentially the electronics in this instrument, it's quite almost like a Frankenstein. This is what makes it very custom. They're all different, and I wanted to have different elements of things that I've tried over the years that I've really enjoyed. So these two pickups, the same pickups in my groove line right here. And these
are essentially
coil
that you're pointing to.
Yeah. These are called the Sonic Arch Cap pickups, made by Ibanez, and they're radiused as well, which is really cool.
Yeah,
So you get a pretty even attack on the strings.
But that's since it's a six string, that's probably got a pretty flat radius on the fingerboard side of the neck.
It's not so flat. There is a slight radius. I can't tell you what the curve is, but when you look at it,
there's some shape to it.
Exactly. Okay. Which is cool. I mean, it's the same on this one as well.
Is it the same headstock too, or is it just the same neck? A little bit different headstock.
Yeah, this is a BTB headstock essentially. Okay. It's mainly the neck that is very close to this. This one's just a little thinner.
Okay.
I wanted to have something just a little thinner. This one has a little more thickness to it. With the Electron, this is the pickups. These are essentially in the typical 60s jazz bass spacing.
Okay.
Which is the same on this instrument too. And I really like that sound, especially there's a vibe about that whole back pickup in the 60s that I like.
60s versus 70s, yeah. But
yeah,
now,
which I prefer.
Wasn't the neck always the same? Like the neck jazz pickup was always in the same place. It was just the 70s that they bumped it closer to the bridge.
Just a little bit. And that makes such a difference.
It does.
Obviously, when we listen to people like Marcus Miller, that slap sound is very distinctive of a 70s jazz bass with that being just slightly closer to the bridge.
You get that extra tension coming off the bridge.
Exactly. A little more brightness as well. But I really like the 60s. That's me. That's my preference. And then this P pickup is not typically in a typical P bass position.
Yeah, it looks closer to the bridge than it would normally be.
Which is really cool because it's just a little different.
Yeah.
I think the cool thing is that it can fit in between these two pickups.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's an Aguilar pickup. So totally different from that. It's just because they were one of the only pickup companies that have a six-string P-bass pickup on hand ready to go. I know Kari Nordstrand does one, but at the time when we were doing this, I don't think it was available. But speaking of Nordstrand, the preamp is a Nordstrand preamp. Because I've played some basses with Nordstrand preamps in there, and they've just been absolutely wonderful. And so I wanted to include that in there. So now the switching.
Yeah.
Essentially, the switches, the three on the top here.
Right. So just for the audio version of this, there's a row of three toggles on top, followed by a row of two toggles on the bottom, and then we have five knobs. So we'll go through all
that. Yeah. So the three switches on the top are just on and off switches for each pickup.
Oh, okay.
Just as simple like that. So right now when they're all down, the bass is off.
Okay.
When I put on the first switch, it's this neck pickup.
The neck single coil.
Yep. And then the one in the middle is the P-Bass Aguilar pickup.
Uh-huh.
And so forth. And then, so I can have different combinations, which is really cool. I can have all three on if I want. I can have the neck single coil and the P-Bass and vice versa.
I'm curious about this because when I was co-designing my signature, I was reading up a lot about pickup placements and phase cancellation. Now, I know that when both jazz pickups on a standard jazz are full out, you're going to experience some phase cancellation. What about this P pickup so close to the neck or the bridge jazz pickup? Do you experience any phase cancellation there?
No.
Anything you notice? Like the sound doesn't suffer? No, you're really getting full of both?
I'm definitely getting full. That's for sure.
Okay. Got some brand new strings on there too.
These are newer strings. I mean, what you're probably hearing too is my microphone.
Yeah,
probably also picking up some
noise. I'm not sitting in front of a bass amp.
Right? You're
in New Zealand,
right? But essentially, I mean, I put these strings on a couple of weeks ago, and I mean, I've been playing this bass so much that they're already they're worn in a lot. So that's the other thing too. But yeah,
are they nickel or steel?
These are nickel. They're GHS. Use GHS strings, and I like the nickel wound just because they have a nice slick feel.
Smoother, not too bright.
Exactly. I'm not so much into the bright, but I can get the brightness if I want. Like for slapping, it's totally doable. That's right. Why, you know, you got an active preamp. So the two switches on the bottom, essentially, one of them is an active and passive switch, which is very handy.
Sure.
Obviously, the battery dies. This is 18-volt battery.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The battery dies. You need a generator
to plug right into the base.
Exactly. Yeah. It's almost like an alembic, you know, where you have like a power amp, you know, like, you know, it's really cool. But yeah, active and passive. And then I have a mid frequency switch. So just when it's in the up position, I don't know the exact frequencies, but well, I can give you an idea what it sounds like. So in the up position, it's doing the lower mid. So right now it's flat. And then if I turn it up, and then it does that on the down position, it does the higher mids.
Okay.
So you can adjust it however you want it, which is really cool.
Yeah.
So
super and then, versatile.
Very. And then typical 3-band EQ, and then a volume, a master volume knob, and then this other knob I have is just a passive tone control.
Okay.
Which works in both active and passive.
Yeah, because
I still like you know, like on the old passive basses, I like to have, instead of having to use a treble, which doesn't necessarily kind of cut all the treble.
Right.
I like to have a tone knob that actually makes it warm, but takes away the string noise if necessary.
Sure.
And then also, I can, even with the tone rolled all the way on, like to its full brightness, I can still get a nice warm sound, but with a little brightness, a little more vintage jazz bass, with the treble rolled all the way off,
right,
which is really cool. Sometimes I'm not so much into like the hi-fi, like tweeter box sound.
yeah, I know what you mean.
You know, there's a time and place for it.
Yeah, I feel like that sound is, you know, very much a part of specific genre vocabulary. Like the gospel guys kind of have that sound, and that's crushing for that genre.
Absolutely. You know,
because they're getting a lot of slap stuff, really percussive playing, and all that'll pop. Yeah.
Definitely cut through. I think just for my ears, sometimes, and for me personally, I can't handle too much string noise, especially if there's, you got cymbals and whatnot that are in that register as well, hi-hats, and sometimes it can just be, maybe it's just my ears, my hearing is going, right. I don't know.
It comes along with the heartburn.
exactly, yeah, and the gray hairs, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. And then this is a bolt-on, of course.
Okay.
It's not a neck-through, a typical BTB's neck-through. I asked for a bolt-on because I've never had a neck-through bass, so I'm not necessarily used to a neck through, and also it's just an easier build when it's a bolt on.
Right.
And it's just something that I'm used to. And that was something that when I was giving the specifications of this instrument, you know, the dude said to me, like, look, don't go all extravagant and put things that you are not familiar with, because we might make something and you might not actually like it. Because that is common.
And so how did you feel about, because this is the process I went through. I sent him the specs.
Yeah.
I had no idea how it was going to turn out.
Like, yeah, exactly.
And then I even had like a custom pickup built. And Howard Ulliate built the pickup, and we were talking back and forth about it. And I'm like, well, man, what if we just switch the coils on this pickup? Like a complete experiment. I have no idea how it's going to sound. And then finally all of it showed up one day, and I'm just like, all right, well, what did I really do here? Like, how is this going to turn out? So you didn't play any of these ideas before you sent them the specs. You're just like,
no,
this seems cool.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what really helped was like using stuff that was familiar to myself. So obviously the wood combinations, the body is very similar to my Ibanez Groove Line. So older body with ash tops.
Okay.
But I wanted to have a maple neck so that it can just be, look, this is obviously a rosewood, you know, fingerboard.
It almost looks ebony. Like that's a dark piece of rosewood.
Right. It definitely is. This has such a beautiful, warm, solid mm-hmm. sound, and it's very heavy as well.
Yeah.
That's why it's such solid as a rock. This is much lighter.
Is it chambered? Is this one chambered?
This is not chambered. This is just a solid body. But a lot of the hardware, this is a hip shot bridge. It's very light. And the tune is a hip shot. And I have a
detuner.
For the B string as well.
Yeah, you got the Goucher knob.
Exactly, yeah. Which is really cool. I've never really done that, but I thought, well, why not? It would be cool to go down to A? It does, yeah. Okay. So,
oof,
exactly. And I'm still figuring out how to play it at that tension, because obviously when you do it, it's way more loose and floppy, and just getting the attack so that it doesn't buzz so much.
How are you processing this mentally? Like when the string is tuned to A and it's detuned. And you go to reach for a note, and in your mind, it's going to be this note at that fret.
Do you
have to always be thinking, whole step down, whole step down, whole step down, whole step down.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's a lot of time when I haven't really figured it out.
Yeah.
I'm trying to use the concept of back when I was younger and playing four strings and doing the whole drop D thing on the occasional tune. And that seemed to be fine. But I guess when you have so many more strings and then you add this,
that one variable. Yeah,
exactly. That just adds so much. Like what? Definitely. I mean, when I play along with records, just to practice with that, I definitely mess up for sure. So it's something I just have to practice more, because I try to think about it and it doesn't work. Yeah. That's the thing.
I had my custom signature that I co-designed was a five string fretless, and I had it strung E through C for a little while, and I was practicing
nice.
And finally took it to a gig, and I brought a standard tuned five string to the gig also, just in case.
Sure.
You know, as a safety net. I lasted like a tune, you know, with its stroke and I'm just like, I can't think about it. Like I can't process this string and all that with so much conditioning of where these notes are gonna be.
Right.
So I'm gonna be a fourth off, and then I'm thinking about what to do, you know, how I'm gonna play through changes and stuff and process the bass. It was too much. It was way too much.
It really is. Yeah. It is just so much. And when you just want to play music, just want to play bass, and you got, and I know, I'm sure you've had conversations with some of the older cats when the five string and the six string first came around, and some of these cats switched to playing five string, and they went through the same thing as well, with this extra string. Like,
oh, I know
what's going on.
When did you make the jump? Did you go right from four to six, or did you have the Gateway 5 in there?
No, I definitely had the Gateway 5. About 20 years ago, I jumped to five string. I was playing a lot of four string, and I still have the four string that I, which is also an Ibanez, just an Ibanez sound gear from the early 90s.
Oh, wow.
I played that for a long time, and it got to a point where I was wanting that low B.
Yeah.
At the time, I also did not know what an octave pedal was either. And so I'd be listening to some records, and I know that the player is playing a four string bass, but how is this person getting those low notes? Like, are they tuning down? I thought they just tuned down. So, of course, I wanted to go to the five string. So I got that. And then eventually, when I was 14, I was starting to get more into playing jazz. And, of course, people like John Patitucci.
Sure. Jimmy Haslip. There's a whole, Haslip, right.
Yeah, even Nathan East as well plays a lot of six string, and I'm like,
Anthony
oh
Jackson, yeah.
man, exactly. Yes, that's when, also when I discovered Anthony Jackson, I'm like, wow, I need a six string. And growing up in New Zealand, they didn't really have six string. Well, they didn't actually in six string basses in the music shops.
Really?
They really didn't. Yeah,
Okay.
it's like the cats. Some of the cats in New Zealand who did have six strings, they had bought those basses overseas, like in
Okay.
Australia, or if they'd gone wherever. But so I'm like, how am I going to get a six string? So
Yeah.
eventually I was able to special order a C string and
Okay.
do the whole, like you mentioned, do the
Yeah.
whole E to C so that I could get that upper range, but I still missed that low
Yeah.
B. So eventually, I got a six string, which was actually which was an Ibanez BTB
Okay.
bass, and I had that for
So they've been
many
a part of
years.
your, the Ibanez has been a part of your just career since day one.
Almost since day one. My very first bass was
Yeah, let's get
this
into this.
very cheap.
Yeah,
I
me
mean,
too.
it look
There's
a
no
bit. It's
shame. There's no shame. Mine was a PV Fury P bass that cost
oh, that was.
$125 from a
Oh man,
pawn
it was
shop.
better than what I had. I think my one was something called a Pro Axe or something.
Yeah,
At the time, I mean, I was 7 years old. I didn't
right.
care. I had a bass guitar.
Yeah,
Like, oh my
exactly.
gosh, I have a bass guitar.
And when you're just starting
And
out, you can't tell the difference of any of it, you know? Yeah, it
no,
doesn't matter. Yeah.
exactly. You don't care. And eventually upgraded to the Ibanez. And it was so amazing. An active bass, it's smaller, has a
Yeah.
nice slim neck. It was perfect for, especially at the time, like 8, 9 years old on that
Sure.
bass.
Man, that's
Perfect.
I've told students a lot about Yamaha basses, not Yamaha basses, Ibanez basses, specifically when they want to go from four to five string because of the string spacing on the Ibanez five. It's a really easy transition for your hand. Now, where the strings are is a little bit different, but you're not holding this really big neck, you know, like the Yamaha TRB has a huge neck.
Oh yeah,
You know,
the
like that
six
was
string,
my first
yeah.
five string, and it was like, oh my
Wow,
gosh, this
yeah.
is obnoxious. But the string
Yeah.
spacing was normal. You know, it was equivalent to the four. But Ibanez really has a good thing going with that smaller neck thing. It's great for younger students, or if you want to have a bass with more strings and not have
Exactly.
a
Yeah,
boat
it's
paddle.
exactly. Especially that I guess they get that concept from a lot of their guitars. When you look at a lot of the guitar players who play their guitars, a lot of them are like amazing shredders,
Right.
technicians. It's like super easy to play. So I can see why they put that concept into the bass guitars as well.
Yeah.
Now my five string, when I had a five string, it wasn't an Ibanez. It was
Okay.
actually it was a Washburn.
Washburn. Okay.
And it was great that it was an old XB model. I loved it, but obviously I went back to the Ibanez
Sure.
with the six string and then just have just stayed true with the Ibanez. So
Yeah.
and I have had Fenders and all that over the years. I even had a Marcus Miller Fender
Okay.
bass, a couple of jazz basses that
I
I put
had the
together.
75 reissue that the
Oh,
Marcus
okay.
was before he sent it over to Roger and Sadowski put the pre on it. But I had that bass when it was just from Fender, like the Japanese 75 reissue. That was a great jazz bass. Like I like that bass.
They were very popular. And of
Yeah.
course, when the five strings came out, you saw a lot of cats using those as
Yeah.
well. I think for me, I just wasn't a huge fan of at least the one that I had. Maybe it was a later model, but I wasn't a
Okay.
fan of the preamp. It was just too mid-scoopy for me.
Yeah.
And I guess the thing that you had to do was you had to get the Roger Sadowski preamp and
Right.
like put that in.
Right. Yeah.
So
Yeah.
that was
To
the
get the
thing.
mids. I mean, if you want like more of the Jaco thing, you're gonna need the mids.
Right,
Yeah.
exactly. And I love having a full tonal
Sure.
palette naturally and being able to cut or boost
Yeah.
just so it's there.
Yeah. Now, is this space going to be on the market? Is there going to be a retail aspect for this space?
I don't know. This is just a custom just one kind of for me.
For you, yeah.
But it's it's possible that could be a thing in the future, especially nice. the three pickup configuration.
Yeah, they don't have anything like that. I haven't even seen anything like that since Stu's base.
Yeah, it's not very common as such. I think there's a boutique company that make the short scale bases, Sarek. I've seen them.
Yeah, I know you're talking about
Sarek. Yeah, I've seen that they make some bases with three pickups in there, and then I think maybe like Madison over in Europe. You know, the ones that like Yannick Guzdala
plays.
And Hendrik Lindner. They've made some bases that. I mean, pretty much any company could make them. It's really no big deal. I think it's just the whole two pickup has just been like an industry standard.
Yeah. I mean, everything. I really like when companies kind of break the Fender model a little bit.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, because everything is a derivative of something that Leo Fender came up with. You know, it's like a jazz or a music man. So it's like anytime they do something that breaks the Fender model, breaks the Fender body shape, or just breaks the Fender model a little bit, I'm always a little bit more interested in, because like, let's see what else can happen, you know, with the instrument.
Absolutely. I guess that, you know, an early example of something like that, of breaking that model, would be like Alembic or Carl Thompson, if we're looking like the late 60s, early 70s, something that's just totally different than a Fender, which is really cool. And then, of course, you know, the bass having to use an external like power supply to power it. And having this, like, I mean, the Alembic has a very unique, like the controls itself. Yeah. And some of them I've seen with multiple, more than two pickups as well.
Okay. I think I've played one like way back in the day. But that's a bass you don't see around a lot.
Not a whole lot. I mean, that's a very boutique.
Very boutique. Like, I mean, I don't even think expensive. I can go to the amp shop. I don't even think they have one in stock. You know, like if someone just wanted to check one out for, I mean, they're not going to let you check it out just to check out. But if you wanted to, if you had the money and were interested and wanted to check one out. And I remember them being really long scale. Like, I remember them, being really, really long.
Yeah, they have some very long scale. I know the ones that Stanley Clark plays are short scale.
Okay. Which that's interesting, because he's tall.
He's huge. And it's a super thin neck as well. And he does use the lighter gauge Rotosound strings on there. So that's why he get, you know, very percussive and a lot of bends as well. And it is an interesting electronic system as well, how essentially it's like it's a stereo bass. Each pickup, just like the Rickenbacker the Rickosound, right?
Right. Someone else who broke the Fender mold, that, you know, very, very specific sound.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, how Chris Squire got his sound, each pickup into a different amp, which is really cool.
Yeah, I know.
You know, which is wild. Yeah, like, okay, more amps.
That's not for the local gigging bass player. That's not a working bass player thing.
No, absolutely not. But I think that the fact that kind of technology and option is there, I think, is just it's cool to see that is something that is available and, you know, can possibly be done. Obviously, we know of Billy Sheehan, who wires his bass in stereo as well, which is to get his sound. So it's always really cool just seeing the different concepts that have just over the last 50 years.
I think that's it, man. I think it is. It's fundamentally, it's a concept of sound, and it's you know, like, what were the records, or who were the bass players you were checking out that really helped shape your concept of sound?
Sure. For me, it definitely starts with Stanley Clark, just because, especially when I first got into the bass guitar, My dad had some Stanley Clark records, and so of course, like that was the first thing that I heard as well. That album, If This Bass Could Only Talk.
Yeah,
and that's where I was like, wow, oh my god, that sounds amazing. Just the percussiveness, because I had just come from playing the drums.
Right.
So I was like, okay, this like sounds like drums, yeah, but it's got something. And then you could play bass. And then John Entwistle was another person early on that I was listening to a lot. The Who.
These records at Around the House? Because those are very time specific, or at least timeline wise, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Those are in the same era, like early Stanley records and The Who.
Absolutely, yeah. These were records that my dad had. Stanley Clark, the Who. He had a lot, all the Weather Report records. Mm-hmm. So I had just heard a bit of Jaco, but I guess I hadn't got into it straight away. I was more into playing rock and roll at that stage. So I was getting into Pink Floyd.
Okay.
Stanley
records are the perfect. Kind of. The perfect crossover for that. Before you get into Weather Report, and you got, you know, Zayn all doing all the weird bomb sounds.
Absolutely.
And,
it really was. Especially as I got older and starting to get more into jazz, the whole thing of jazz fusion, of course. So for me, Stanley Clark being the center of my bass universe of how I branched off to discover all these different musicians. So of course, from Stanley, like, I go back to like people, like Miles, Charlie Parker, Dizzy, whatnot, sure. Coltrane, and then going forward to Chick Corea, Herbie, and then even Alan Holdsworth, Tony Williams. So like it just
start following the different branches, and you end up
Charles Mingus, of course. So that's the thing. There was a bass player in particular I really enjoyed who played with Pink Floyd. Later on, like after Roger Waters, there's a guy named Guy Pratt.
Okay.
Who's a British bass player. He actually played a lot with Roxy Music and also with Madonna as well.
Oh, wow.
But he in particular was how I actually got into the octave pedal. So
really?
He was using it with Pink Floyd. And this is the dude I was referring to where I'm like, He's playing a four-string Spector bass, but how is he getting like all those low notes? But also it sounds like that you can clearly hear the double.
Right. You sound. Can hear both octaves, yeah.
Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Like eventually, I don't know, I think it was a magazine or whatever, or maybe a music shop where someone was trying out an octave pedal and I was like, there, that's that sound.
That's what it is.
Yeah. You know, like this is me, like 11 years old, going, what is that? You know, and of course, it's someone was trying out an OC2 octave pedal, and I said, okay, I need to have.
That's the holy grail of octave pedals.
Exactly, yeah. And then of course, Pino Palladino being another person who's a master of the octave pedal with the fretless, but Guy Pratt early on. Was it for me? And he does some great stuff with the octave pedals. Like there's a tune, a Pink Floyd tune in particular called Sorrow, where he really goes to town. And then also Michael Jackson's Earth Song, he plays on that one with the octave pedal.
Okay.
It's just beautiful. So I still to this day, I love the octave pedal a lot.
Playing the Boss? Or you still have the OC2?
I don't. I actually use an EBS pedal. I did have the OC pedal for quite a while. And then I tried out the EBS and I was like, oh, I really enjoy this. So it was just my preference.
Yeah. What was that for you that made you prefer the EBS? Like I specifically remember talking to Steve Jenkins about effects.
Yeah.
And I even like, after we did the podcast thing, like I've hit him up on the side. I'm like, all right, dude, I need to know what's up. Like you're deep in the pedal game, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not a super pedals guy, but I was interested in some specific sounds. What was it for you specifically with the EBS octave pedal? And what is it when you know you land on the right brand of effect? Like, what is it that you're kind of hearing?
Yeah. So for me, a big one is tracking, the way that it tracks. And I felt that the EBS had a little better tracking, especially because I do like to use the octave pedal even in solo. So being able to track when you play some fast stuff, and then even playing like lower down, like down here, I don't have the pedal hooked up obviously, but playing like this kind of note, wanting it to track down that low and not glitch out.
Sure.
That was, and then also I felt that for the sound that I was going for.
Sorry to interrupt. Do you prefer digital tracking over analog tracking then? Is there like a common thread through what you respond to with the different trackings?
Yeah, I haven't thought about that. I just and I don't even know if maybe the EBS is digital or analog. I'm not too sure. But
it's something I only learned about semi-recently, is like when I was Chorus pedal shopping. And I was comfortable with the old Boss, you know, whatever it is, CEB or something.
Yeah.
But then I realized that there's two of them. There's a gray label and then there's the OG one. And I'm like, well, what's the difference? And so I'm reading about tracking, and the gray label is the digital tracking. And I'm like, oh, that's a thing. So then I went down the rabbit hole of reading people's commentary about digital tracking and stuff like this.
Right.
I mean, I haven't A-beat them. This was during the pandemic, and like, all I could get was the digital tracking one, you know, because like nothing was coming in. Like all the companies were backlined or, you know, held up. Nobody was bringing in new equipment.
Right.
So I could get the digital ones and I checked it out. But it was something I was unaware of. I never thought about digital versus analog tracking.
I'm totally unaware of it. Maybe that is a thing. It's interesting to know what. Maybe it is. But The EBS, it just felt a little more natural sounding to me, especially when you turn off the dry signal and just have just the wet signal, so just the octave below.
Yeah.
It felt a little, I wanted to have the sound of like just a very smooth sub bass sound. Not so much like an electronica, and that's the unique thing about the OC pedal, is that when you have it just on that low octave, it gives a very unique, like kind of like dubstepy almost sound, which I could understand is very popular amongst players who really want to get that. So people like Steve Jenkins, of course, Tim LaFave, even Yannick gets into that as well when he does his that kind of stuff.
He's got a ridiculous pedal collection.
I mean, he probably has like 10 different OC2s. Which is insane. And you know, and since we're talking about digital and analog, there's probably a bunch of them that are
he knows which are which, and he'd be a good guy to talk to about all that stuff.
Absolutely, for sure. Juan Alderete as well as another guy.
Who is that?
Juan Alderete.
Oh, I don't think I know him.
The dude from the Mars Volta.
Oh, okay.
He's a huge pedal guy, and actually that's the reason why Yannick is such a big pedal guy as well, is those two guys put together like a pedal library.
Essentially. I see. Yeah. I forgot what record it is. But Michelle Indigacello plays one on some record, and like her, I mean, it is a very, it's an amazing bass sound. She always has an amazing bass sound.
Absolutely.
But that octave sound, and I think I probably, knowing me, tried to figure out what she was using or what she did on that record. But that's probably one of my favorite octave sounds.
Absolutely. And probably a big contributor to that is OC2 matched with a Fender Jazz bass.
Yeah, yeah. I think she's got a 64J or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Like it's those two. made for each other.
Yeah.
Classic combination. Because even Jaco played an OC pedal. I think it might have been an OC1 or something. Or OC2.
Really?
But yeah, there are times where you would, like live, you'd hear him play with an octave. I think even on Teen Town, he might have even used an octave on that, especially on
really? I'm going to have to go back and check that out. I never thought about it.
But live, that he used an octave pedal at times, like just like real, like sparingly.
Yeah.
Like
that's interesting for him.
Yeah, exactly. Especially like for the like late 70s, early 80s, it was being a newer thing.
Yeah, because like when he would use chorus, it's a ton of chorus. When he would do like the distortion thing, it's a ton of fuzz. Like he was always
right.
It was always those like old effects amps. On or off. There's no real blend.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean that's how it was back then. Anyway, it's like now obviously we can just blend it in, so it's just like so like subtle.
Just get back a little
texture. Exactly. Back then it was just like 0 to 100.
Yeah, exactly.
And the acoustic 360 bass amps that he was using with the fuzz.
Yeah.
And he didn't use a foot switch. Obviously, we've seen the videos of him like cranking it on.
Yeah. What is it? The Joni Mitchell Shadow of Light, like DVD where he just turns around. I think it's him and who was on that? Was that Alex Acuna?
Don Elias. So Don Elias was the drummer.
Yeah.
Of course, Michael Brecker,
right,
Pat Metheny. Yeah. I mean, it's like an incredible band.
I love that record. But on the live, he turns around, just flips the switch and does his solo bass thing, all Hendrix-y.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really amazing. You know, with Peter Erskine, obviously being played with Jaco so many times or Weather Report, I asked Peter, I was like, so how loud? Well, first of all, how loud was that band?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, it was incredibly loud. It's like a rock band.
It's a rock band, like, well, right.
How loud was Jaco? And he said, probably like, if not the loudest. And the reason is he would have four of those cabinets on stage. He would have two behind him and then he would have two as side fills.
Oh my God.
So whenever he'd walk around the stage, it would be this like huge like sound of just his bass. And those cabinets were an 18-inch speaker.
The 218s, right? Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a single 18, but it had a folded horn. So because it was designed to throw the sound all the way to the back of the room. So the person at the back of the room is just getting pummeled.
Yeah.
But that's just with one. You know, you got four of them and you're just like, it's just insane. But I mean, that was the sound of Jaco. And obviously, I wasn't around when Jaco was. The only times that a lot of us have heard Jaco is on recordings.
Right.
There must have been, obviously, to hear someone like Jaco in the same room would have been an absolutely different experience.
Oh, yeah.
To hear his bass with your own ears, because you hear, obviously, the room and everything and the intensity. So the thing.
I've never thought about this or never read it, but what kind of rig, maybe you know, would he bring to the 55 bar when he was doing all those punk jazz records were bootlegged?
Right. Yeah, like with Mike Stern.
I mean, I didn't even know how many of them there are, but those are some of my favorite Jaco records.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from what I've been told from many sources who were there, he would just plug into whatever was there.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes someone would bring in a bass rig, and actually towards the end of his life, he was messing around with Larry Harkey cabinet, which was essentially a converted Ampeg SVT 810.
Okay.
Larry just had, he had made the aluminum cone speakers and put that in there. And he still has that cabinet to this day. And he says, no one has plugged into it since Jaco has.
Oh,
he
says,
no one ever will.
Okay.
So
he was museum piece.
Exactly. Yeah. But he would plug into that. sometimes he would even, when he was playing like rehearsals or recording with Joni Mitchell, she used to use the Roland JC120,
mm-hmm.
and they made it specifically for her as well.
Oh.
And he would always plug into that, and she'd be like, well, what am I going to plug into? Because he loved the sound of that. So actually, a lot of the Mingus record was done with Jaco plugged into a JC120.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. That's hilarious.
It really is.
You've played with Mike Stern also, and you played with Peter Erskine. What did that feel like the first time you got, you know, like the first hit you're going to do with them, and you're in this lineage of a great like Jaco Pastorius and all the other people that they've all played with, you know? Mike Stern coming from Miles Davis and all that. And now you're a part of this, your lineage. How'd that feel?
Well, it's, first of all, I'd say it is the absolute honor. One of the most exciting things that I'm very grateful to have had that opportunity to play with those cats. It was definitely a very memorable moment for me that I'll always remember, especially at the time when I first played with Mike Stern. I was 24 years old.
Speaking of Jaco and bass history, I mean, that's how old he was when he cut the record, you know?
Absolutely.
Kind of a special time in your career and how that matches up with all of that.
Yeah, the timing at the time, it worked out, because at the time I was also playing with Lee Ritenour,
mm-hmm.
in his band, and we were doing a guitar, this guitar festival, and Lee said, oh, well, you know, you can use, why don't you use some of the cats from my band to play? And so it was cool. And so we got sent the tunes of Mike's tune, and meeting Mike for the first time, he was just such a wonderful, warm, charismatic, nice. and excited person. Okay. Obviously, this is someone who just lives and breathes music every single day. Like he is music. And he's always down to play with anyone. Exactly. You can even like hit him up in the middle of the night and be like, hey, you want to like shed?
Yeah.
and he's like, yeah, okay. It's really cool. So he was always down to practice and always encouraging as well. And just a lot of fun. A lot of fun. That was a cool thing. So that's what made the experience it's so wonderful, was that, there's this amazing, monstrous musician who we've like, a lot of us have looked up to and seen a lot of record, but the fact that they're also just such a wonderful human being and is giving me such a great experience, and I'm able to really enjoy and have fun with it. It's definitely made the whole thing so memorable. And same thing with someone like, you know, Peter Erskine as well. I was definitely nervous about that at first, because I think because of my weather report background and someone who was very close to Jaco,
mm-hmm.
and the thing that you want to do but also don't want to do as well is play your Jaco stuff. Exactly. And also, he's just heard so many other people like play.
He's
it.
Heard all the clones. He was there for the original, and he's still around for everybody who's topped it since.
Exactly. So the first time playing with him, I was very conscious to not so much do that, even though there was a tune on the very first Dr. Gig that I did with him. We did a weather report tune, where I have to play a fretless melody.
Okay.
Like Jaco. And this is a tune called...
Was it a remark you made? Were you playing that?
It wasn't that one. It was a tune called Speechless.
Okay.
Which is from the self-titled Weather Report album from 1982.
Okay.
And I know that tune very well, and I'm like, I, you know, for me, the way that that's played, it has to be phrased the way that Jakku does. Because for me, that's what makes it go. And so I had figured out like the chorusing with the delay and all that to get that sound, because that was the only way that I was going to be able to play it. Because it was a certain standard and it had to be kind of somehow met on that level. Even though by any means I definitely not Jakku at all, but I think channeling that energy and that vibe is something that's going to give way to that song. And so just that sound check, I had that sound close enough, and Peter leant over to me and he leant over and went like this. And I'm just like, he hates it all. I know he hates it. He's like, you're one of the first people that I've come across that actually has gotten very close to that sound.
Oh yeah.
That chorusing. Like, and he's like, how did you do it? I'm just like, I was just using a Boss delay pedal just to kind of get the chorusing so close, because I didn't have a chorus pedal. And then over time, as we got to know each other and play more together, I could start bringing out the Jakku stuff. So like, especially, and he would get a kick out of it too if we would be playing, you know, like the stuff like that. Like that, he would, and afterwards he'd be like singing to me. He'd be going do 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 do. So we had a lot of fun, and I think the way that he sees it, because I've asked him about all the Jakku stuff, the Jakku, like, I like, tell me more, Uncle Peter, tell me more Jakku stuff. Yeah, I think a way is that it keeps the legacy alive.
Sure.
Of not just Jakku, but that kind of music, an era that he was a part of.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys at the time, I mean, they were on top of the world, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was definitely.
I mean, it'd be
Peter
like,
was super young too.
You know, to think about another drummer who was in a specific place and time within music history, it'd be like playing bebop with Roy Haynes. You know, just
exactly.
Like it's so much. You would want. I would love to play that stuff with Roy Haynes. You know what I mean? Like this
absolutely.
Is the dude that did it, and it does it
for sure.
It keeps pushing that thing forward because it's such a beautiful part of American music.
That's right. And it's become, also become a vocabulary and a essential, like, standard style of playing the instrument. Obviously, we look at Roy Haynes, we look at Elvin Jones, we look at Tony Williams, Philly Joe. Those ways of playing are obviously studied in jazz school. And also, there are a lot of drummers over the time who incorporated that, and it's the same thing with bass, the whole back pickup playing, the ghost notes. This shows how this instrument has evolved over time from being the typical beginnings. We look at like the Fender P bass, the whole Monk Montgomery, the James Jamison.
Monk Duck Montgomery, Dunn. Solid reference. Yeah, he doesn't
absolutely.
Get enough love. He doesn't get enough
exactly.
love.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is a thing I always teach my students is look, the first electric bass player is, as far as we know, really is Monk Montgomery.
Yeah. On that Art Farmer record.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, incredible upright player too, but being also on electric bass really pushed it forward.
Yeah.
And it's important to, you know, this is a thing, going back to what I was saying with about legacy, keeping something alive, is that if we keep talking about these cats, they're still around.
Yeah.
In some way. And so with Peter seeing me as of the younger generation and being into all these cats like Jakku, it's like, okay, well, we have a future where this is still
it's,
going to be
it's
around.
Going to live on and that'll still be relevant, you know, and it's relevant
absolutely.
Through the players that have like yourself that have spent the time to really study it, not just like play 16th notes or play fast.
Right.
But to like right. really get into not only the vocabulary of Jaco, but his sound, his fire, like the way his yeah. right hand, like the fire in his right hand, not oh, just speed,
insane.
But he just had this edge, you know, that you can hear. I mean, I have, and I'm sure you have too. You hear so many dudes playing the left hand Jaco stuff, but like,
yes. Yeah.
So much of it was his right, like just his absolutely. Energy was just a, it was on he fire. No in. One has that feel. Like even if they put it a little on top, it's yeah, he dug in hard.
He really did, and he had high action.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that from, actually.
From I and the only reason I know that is, my bass teacher back in college at Cal Arts was Alfonso Johnson.
Yeah, I studied with Alfonso too. Did you talk you to did. Him about Jaco? Yeah, I did. Did you absolutely. Talk to him about yeah? I felt awkward bringing up Jaco. Like,
oh yeah,
because I had before the first couple lessons, I went out and bought a ton. I went out to Amoeba and bought like everything I could find with Alfonso on it.
Yeah,
like I could wow. be informed about like, okay, dude, I've heard you do this. I heard you do this. Like, ask him questions. I think if I remember right, the weather report was called Tail Spinning.
Yes.
With Alfonso. And I checked it yeah. out, and it's a very different weather report experience.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so we were talking, and he's like, who do you listen to? And I'm just like, Jaco. Like, you kind of got probably fired from the band for him. I didn't talk to him about that, but. Yeah, I felt awkward talking to him about Jaco.
Sure. Just to
amazing human, by the way. Amazing human.
Obviously.
He dropped some like really heavy conceptual information on me that still, I mean, back then completely flipped my thing, and still I yes. think about and talk to with students. He's absolute lovely human and amazing bass
absolutely.
Player.
Absolutely, yeah. yes. And just for you know, for the record. The transition from him to Jaco, Alfonso, he left on good terms. He okay. decided that good. He wanted to move on and do some other things.
Yeah.
Cause his buddy, the great drummer Chester Thompson was also leaving, but they were in the middle of, doing that record Black Market. Cause mm-hmm. that the record Black Market is a bit of Alfonso and a bit of Jaco.
Yeah.
And so they had recorded that at the end of 1 year and were continuing to record it at the beginning of the next year. I think okay. from like 75 to 76 or something. So 76 yeah. is when Jaco came on board.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually worked out. So there was no like firing okay. Or anything. I think it was definitely different with Miroslav, Vitas, yeah. and Alfonso. Like Miroslav... they actually asked him to leave.
Oh, really? Because they wanted electric?
Poor dude. You know, yeah. I mean, Miroslav is one of my favorites.
Sure.
But they wanted to go into more like funk oriented, like electric bass yeah. Direction. And Miroslav, we know him as absolutely one of the great upright bass players.
Yeah.
Virtuosos. And he played a little bit of electric, but he wasn't. Like those guys,
right? Right. Did you ever see that DVD with Matheny? Who's it? Matheny, Dave Holland, Herbie?
Oh,
I forgot who's yeah. on drums. Maybe
Jack DeJohnette.
Yeah, yeah. But like,
yeah.
But Holland pulls out a P bass, and it's the only time I've yes. ever seen Dave Holland play an electric bass.
It's, yeah, it's funny he's to a me. Wonder. He's a you know he. I actually dig his. Electric bass playing. There's not a whole lot of like, you know, cats who I've known as just being, I'm not going to mention any names, right. but who are mainly upright bass players. And when they pick up the electric bass, it's like,
it's noticeable. Know? And that's nothing to their musicality or
sure.
proficiency. It's just like, it's another instrument. And like,
dudes
who spend a lot of time doubling, like, you know, it's hard to dabble on either one, I think. Because yeah. they're completely different instruments.
Yeah, absolutely. They really are. And for me, the person who was really great at doubling, and the reason why I got into it, John Patitucci.
Sure.
Someone who is, for me, he's the prime example of why I
now,
play
this
both
is,
instruments.
This is fascinating because Stanley didn't. Stanley, now, you didn't.
Yeah. You know what? You know what's interesting? Yes, yeah, Stanley is the reason why.
I agree
why
with you, actually. First, like, Patitucci, like, he was more of a figure as a doubler to me. But the more I've thought about it, like, Stanley, I think Stanley was the first bass player, band leader to double.
He really was. I mean, because you'd see him on. Well, I mean, he's an upright bass player first.
Yeah.
That was the thing. But you would see him on his own shows. And even, I mean, with Return to Forever, doubling on both. Obviously, the album Romantic Warrior, he's playing both instruments. So, yes, he definitely, you would see him playing both instruments very proficiently, the virtuoso. Yeah. I think what really put the... Because him, he made me want to pick up the upright bass, for sure, after seeing the stuff he was doing. Putting the picture together of being a working bassist of playing both, I definitely gravitated towards Patitucci.
Yeah.
For some reason, but I think Stanley was there.
For me, it was almost an era thing because he was releasing a lot of current content. Or he was going to be on records I was listening to that were coming out as I was getting into it.
Right.
So there was like, it was in my face a lot more.
Yeah.
Than, you know, maybe 15 years previously that Stanley had already done it. And I wasn't aware necessarily of the full trajectory of bass history and all that stuff. But like this was happening now. And it was Patitucci who was on the cover of the magazines and he was a lot more just out there.
Absolutely. So I
was checking him out. And then he just became the guy. And then he's doing the six string thing. And I'm like, what the hell is this? And how does he get the, how's he getting the shape of those lines? Like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
And then he's getting the same lines on upright. Like, holy crap. What is all this?
It really is. I mean, and I got to sit down with Patitucci a little bit and ask him some of these questions. There was a show at
the Whale, right?
Yeah, the Blue Whale.
I saw you post about it, and he sat in, which is like, oh my gosh.
Exactly. Yeah. I was just like, come on, man. You got to come off and play, you know, like for real. And so he played my upright bass. And of course, he sounded like himself, which is just amazing. You know, it's like, yes, it's within you.
I got to play his, which was surreal.
Oh, his upright bass?
I got to play his Pullman. Yeah.
Oh, nice. He's had that a long time.
It's like, I mean,
it's been everywhere.
It was so crazy to like, you know, play the strings. And I'm like, yeah, that's the sound as close as I can duplicate it. You know, sound really comes from him and his hands. But
yeah,
man, that's, you know, he was playing piano and I was playing his Pullman. It was surreal.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's awesome, man. Yeah, he's such a great guy. You know, he was really, you know, when I got to ask him, like coming up with like those lines, like, I mean, how, especially on the sixth string.
Yeah.
And he said, look, I was just, every chance I got, I was just shedding that bass all the time. He said he even like when he first got that bass, and we're talking about the Ken Smith sixth string.
That was his
first. When I got that bass, he said, I was even taking it out on tours where I wasn't using that bass, but just practicing on it, like on the tour bus or in the hotel room. He said he was doing a tour with David Sanborn.
Okay.
And that, you know, he had to play like Marcus Miller lines and all that, and do dance moves with Hiram Bullock and all that, sing backing vocals. And he's playing a four string to do that. He didn't play the six string on that gig, but he took it with him just so he could shed because
just to still be working on it. Yeah,
exactly. And I mean, the level of that bass alone, that Ken Smith that he had, the amount of hours that he had put on that instrument was amazing. And I even asked him, I was like, so how many times do you reckon you played Got a Match on that instrument? You know, he's like too many times.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I mean, because he got that. He said, like, that was a tune that I wanted to get, like, the back of my hand, especially when you have to solo after someone like Chick Corea.
Right.
I totally understand. When I had to solo after someone like Mike Stern.
Right.
Like, I mean, prepping for that gig, you know, if we just backtrack a little bit, prepping for that gig, I practiced so much, like every single day for like hours and hours. I wanted to make sure that I knew the forms of his tunes, that I was just right there to now be this that is, role.
What was your what was your process in preparing for that gig? Because it's a huge gig. You're 24 years old. You're going to be playing with an icon.
You know, we're in a trio format too.
Super like, exposed.
Yeah, exactly. Super exposed.
And that's a very specific type of trio, you know? Like,
yeah,
you have really a very prominent voice as an electric bass player in a trio with Mike Stern. Who's on drums?
Absolutely. Well, it was at the time. It was Lee Rittenhouse's son Wesley.
Oh yeah, okay, I know Wesley.
So it was the three of us. But prepping for that gig, I got sent the music. Essentially, it was like 2 months before the thing I got it. So at first, I was excited. I'm like, all right, wow, here's the music. You know, I downloaded it and just listening through, following along with the charts and making any notes for myself, and then just every day just doing like at least an hour just going through the stuff, and then the songs that I knew that I was going to be taking a solo on, just practicing just the solo sections just to get familiar with it, because I knew like, okay, yeah, being a trio, he likes to open up and like feature the other cats, and that's what he did. And then, so we rehearsed it. It felt like a glove. And then he was like, all right, so we're also going to do this other just jam kind of tune where we just play anything. Essentially, it's just over a groove.
Okay.
And he said, you and I are just going to trade. And I'm okay. Okay. And I mean, it was so much fun. Like it really was, but it was just like, oh man, trading with Mike Stern. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, I mean, sure. So yeah, you know, the moments like that, or when you get to play with people who are better than you, who have like been on the block so many times, who have this experience, that's what really inspires you and brings up your level of musicianship, because obviously you have to hang on.
Yeah.
And so you will do what it takes to do that. And I always tell my students, you know, like always be open to the opportunity of playing with musicians who have a lot more experience and who are better than you as well. I mean, that's something that when we look at Stanley, Patitucci, Herbie Chick, who were playing with, you know, Miles and whatnot. And then you look at Miles, who was playing with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Bud Powell. This is how, like...
Yeah, it's always been being passed down, so to speak, from kind of generation to generation.
Absolutely.
That's how it continues on. Like, it's more of a fusion lineage or a straight-ahead lineage. Like, that's how it's always... working, and I think that's beautiful.
To wrap up,
what do you got coming up? And I know you have a record out that you cut when you were super young. I want to ask you. Well, we don't want to dwell too much on it. I want to know, when was the last time you listened to it? So talk about the name of the record, how old you were, and how long it's been since you've heard it.
Sure, I was probably about around 17, going on 18 when I recorded that. That was like the last time that I was here in New Zealand,
okay,
and moving over to the States to study at CalArts.
Yeah,
that was called Double Play, and essentially that I'll just say this: that record doesn't represent anything that I do now. Obviously, that was my late teens. It was what I was into then, and the last time I listened to it, I'm not too sure, to be honest. It's definitely been a while.
I did a record around that age. I don't know. I think I was maybe 19 or 20, and it was never about necessarily like what I was doing on the bass or what I thought was hip. Maybe it was. I don't know. But it was a Christmas present for my mom.
Okay,
nice. But that's all it was. Nice. Like, that's what I did. I cut a record for Christmas, and it was tunes that I knew she was familiar with. via whatever I wanted to do with them, you know.
Sure.
So there's some like bass duo things on there. There's some like quartet stuff.
Nice.
I've never listened to it in my life. I've never heard it all the way through, ever.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah, you know, I'm okay as well. I am, like, right now, I am working on mine.
That's what I wanted to know. Yeah, cool. What's the instrumentation? Is it more of a produced kind of fusion-y multi-track thing, or is it more like four or five guys in a room, old school? Because I know we've talked a lot about electric bass, but you can play the shit out of the upright. And, like, I remember being at the Falls one time, and you were in the house band.
Oh, the good old Falls.
Yeah, the good old Falls. And I can't remember if they were doing the tune or if I just heard you play it, but you played the B section to Inner Urge at tempo on upright. Oh. And I'm just like, damn. Yeah.
I probably did. I had shared that tune a lot in my call on both this and the upright. And God bless him. We both miss him. A big reason for shedding that tune, that B section, was Zane Musa. Our brother that we miss a lot.
Love that guy.
Especially, he would come up to Cal Arts and hang out, and he would play that tune so fast. And I mean, he would just like shred. It was just he was just unstoppable.
Yeah, you know? So That's a whole other episode we could do of sharing Zane stories.
It really is. Yeah. It really is.
But talk about this record.
Yeah. So it's a work in progress right now. It is multi-tracked for sure. Just because, pandemic and all that. And also just the ability of everyone, a lot of musicians we know can just record at home. So, a lot of it is on keyboards is my good friend Steve Weingart, mm-hmm. who you know we might know from the Dave Weckl band back in the day, or Simon Phillips, Protocol as well. He's a good friend of mine, and he's been playing a lot. And I've been doing his record as well right now. He's working on his. And then, of course, on drums, going to be a couple of different drummers, but so far I've recorded Gene Coy,
you'll
know
him. Amazing.
You know, there's going to be some other cats. Channing Cook Holmes, a good friend of mine. Joel Taylor.
Yeah. I just saw him a couple weeks ago.
Oh, nice. Over at the 1881.
He was actually out here in Venice playing at the Brig, doing that steady he's had for like 25 years or something he's insane.
That gig forever. Yeah. The Brig Band.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Joel and Peter. Also offered, you know, like, hey, you know, like, I'll be down as well.
That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. And my lovely wife, Tara Deva, we have a band together as well. We write music together. So
is it going to be that vocals band? Is it going to be the Ben Shepherd experience, or is she, what's kind of the nature of the music?
It's definitely a bit of both. There's definitely a lot of, there's definitely on some tracks, there's definitely a lot of multi-tracked bass.
Okay.
That's for sure. There's a lot of lead bass.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of bass playing melodies for sure. There is I do have a tune where I am, or two, where I'm playing upright as well.
Oh,
there's
cool.
also something where, you know, the bass plays like a chord melody as well. For those who know my playing, I love to do a lot of chords on the bass. So it features a lot of those elements, which is really cool. And it's been great doing taking my time with the production side, at home. Obviously this whole period has taught us how to be engineers and producers.
Or video editors or podcast editors
exactly,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Everybody's learned some skill.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's something. Would I love to go into a room with musicians and just like cut it? Absolutely. I've done that so many times.
I wish I would have done my record like you're doing yours, because I did mine like 2 days in the studio, had everybody there, and it's just like, oh, all right. Like, it wasn't on them. It was like, I'm always learning about pre-production and give dudes notes, and I didn't want to give them too many notes so that they could just do their thing and let it breathe pretty organically. But I've listened back and there's some things like, okay, it wasn't on their playing. I wish I would have been a little bit more with instruction, or, you know, gave them my vision a little clearer.
Sure.
Because when you're on the clock of 2 days, like, okay, this is take six. Like, if we don't get it by now.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Yeah. And that's the thing with doing it on your own is, and you know, it could be one of the downsides of is that, of course, like if I'm recording a bass solo, I want to get that perfect solo that in my mind that I feel comfortable with. And like, if I'm going to listen back to it later on and be like, oh yeah, that I feel good about that.
Yeah.
I go through like so many takes. And of course, like you get to like take 30.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just, and your chops are just like done.
Yeah, like whatever. I'll come back to it next Thursday. Like I can't deal with it anymore.
Exactly. You get sick of like the same ideas that you're just playing, because on another take, you're like, oh, that idea worked well. Let me try it doing. And now you just hate it. So that's the only thing.
Hold on 1 second. I'll be right back. Hold on 1 second.
Yeah, no worries. All right, just finishing up. Okay, yeah, we're finishing in a couple of minutes. Yep, I know that. Yeah, I'll be there.
Had way too much coffee earlier today.
So much green tea.
Yeah, there's always a couple of times like, oh man, am I gonna be able to make it through an hour? Like,
I know, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, I gotta wrap on in a couple of minutes, so I gotta.
What's lunchtime? Yeah, all good. What's the name of the record, and what is like a projected release date? Also, come back on when it's out. I want to talk about. Yeah, I want to hear it, and then talk to you about the record in general.
Yeah, well,
what are we looking at? What's coming out with it?
So, definitely 2023 with at least maybe a single.
Okay.
Just because I'm in no rush right now to put it out. I really am not. And I don't want to have that pressure. I got to do it right now,
right.
Because I've definitely done that to myself in the past, and I got stressed out and I just couldn't do it. Because I've been, for years, I've been planning this to do a record.
Sure.
So now that like, okay, I actually feel comfortable with taking my time. So sometime next year, that could change. I don't have a name as yet. For the record, a name hasn't come as yet, but I've got about so far like about two, almost three tunes done.
Okay. Or ready for mix done?
Definitely ready for mix.
Okay.
Done. That's for sure. And also just figuring out like how do I, like when it gets mixed, how do I specifically want it to sound. So also getting listening to a lot of references.
Yeah.
Obviously being a bass heavy record, like there's a lot of references of Stanley Clarke.
Sure.
And even some of the early Patitucci records as well. But definitely something that is very relevant sounding to today. So there's a lot of things that I'm definitely discovering. It's a wonderful process of discovering.
Ben, thanks so much for doing this, dude.
Ryan, my Man. Pleasure. Great Man. To rap and
yeah,
catch you know, up chat with you.
Likewise, likewise.
Absolutely, man.
All right. If you are enjoying the Base Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. Please feel free to leave a comment and or rating on said platform. Talking to Ben was absolutely killing. Man, he's in it. He's doing the thing. He's playing with all the cats, you know, like all the cats that Jocko used to play with. He's in it. He's in all of that and carrying on that tradition. And I loved speaking to him about that and the reverence he had for Jocko and all the legends that came before him. Absolutely inspiring. And thank you, Ben. That's about all I got for this one, folks. Thank you to all the new listeners. Welcome to the Base Shed Podcast. As I say at the end of the episode, I probably should have said that at the beginning, huh? Thanks for listening. Hit subscribe and I will catch you on the next one in a minute.